in the ethic of uplift is the same thing, that there is this substantial duty, even amongst those who were accumulating materially in that earlier generation, that their accumulation should be about giving back, should be about a built-in duty to provide for others. So even as people who are benefiting from an elite status, they are tasked with thinking more broadly. So I think it's embedded in a working class, but I think it's a broader set of ethics that I think Black people have had to have over time.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. By joining the book club, you get all new Haymarket titles delivered to your door and a 50% discount on the entire Haymarket website, all for one low price. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and the Haymarket
good
YouTube channel
good
to
evening,
access all of our upcoming events.
And
if you really want
to
help us out,
these Haymarket,
rate and review the podcast on Apple
podcast,
or whatever platform
then
you're listening
back
on.
To my garage. You know it very well. I feel like I'm here all the time. But I'm here now with a very special guest. And I'm very, very excited because we're going to talk about one of the most important books probably of this century. And let me first set the record straight. I'm here with Professor Blair Kelly. We're not related, you know? although I never told you this, there's one uncanny connection is that I'm also a descendant of Blairs. Yes, I'm a Blair, but Jamaican Blair. So different Blairs, but that's another story. Anyway, we have, you know, Professor Kelly and I have a lot in common besides our last names. We're both historians. We both work on Black freedom struggles. We both have two middle initials, which makes us special. We both deal with people who are prone to misspell our last names because they drop that extra E. It's a complaint that we share. But the one thing is that I wish I could be the scholar and writer that Professor Blair L.M. Kelly is. And I'm aspiring. I'm going to make it there one day.
Oh, Lord.
Anyway, so you want to know who she is. She is the Joel R. Williamson Distinguished Professor of Southern Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm old enough to have known Joel. And currently the director of the Center for the Study of the American South, which if you know anything about this is the premier institution in terms of the study of the South, both culturally, politically, and otherwise. And Professor Kelly is the first Black woman to serve in that role since the center's founding 30 years ago. So she is the author of the prize-winning and highly acclaimed book, her first book, Right to Ride, Streetcar Boycotts and African-American Citizenship in the Era of Plessy versus Ferguson, which I think is a misnomer because she goes way back to the mid-19th century. It's really a spectacular book. In fact, it's one of my favorite books because it uncovers a wide range of resistance and coalitional politics. We always focus on bus boycotts of in Montgomery in the 1950s, but in the early 20th century, it's amazing how organized these protests are across class lines, led largely by women, as we shouldn't be surprised anymore. And in many ways, the book challenges the claim that these early protests against Jim Crow urban transportation were conservative, accommodationist, middle class. And, you know, she destroys that myth. And part of the reason she does that is because she pays attention to class. You may be familiar with her podcast, Southern Futures, with Melinda Lowry, or have seen her on CNN or MSNBC. You might have heard her on NPR, on WNYC, on everything right now because the book is really hot. And might have read her pieces in New York Times, Washington Post, The Root, Ebony Magazine, Salon, Jet, and elsewhere. I won't describe the book because we're going to do that in the process, but I want to welcome you, Professor Kelly Blair, to our Haymarket conversation.
Hey, how are you? Thank you so much.
Oh, look, it's a pleasure. I'm very excited to talk about this.
If I could just do a side note about the name and the middle initials. When I realized I was marrying a man with the last name Kelly and it was spelled the right way, I was like, ooh, let me keep both my middle name and my maiden name as my initials so people will think that somehow I am vaguely related to Robert D.G. Kelly and therefore smart. And you know, should be paid attention to.
No, but the LM is cool. And that would mean that if there's any relation, it would be with your husband. But I think he's Alabama from, Kelly, right?
No, he's from Fayetteville, North Carolina.
North Carolina, yeah. Mm-hmm. My Kelly's of South Carolina.
Okay.
And technically, I'm not really a Kelly, but that's another story people could read about. So let's get to the book. I have many, many questions and comments and thoughts about it, but I want to just sort of begin for those who may not be familiar with, you know, how you came to write this book the way you did, because it is definitely the richest history or what I call a biography of the Black working class you can find, but the kind of traditional, you know, we're going to go through different industrial unions and different eras. It's told through stories, not just of your family, though that's very important, but other stories of very significant people or people who've never heard of, who actually carry the entire history of Black life, at least for the last couple hundred years, at least more than that, really. So if you could talk about like how you decided to come to this project that way, to talk about the Black working class, and maybe in doing so, share with us the promise of the Black working class.
So I was really intimidated when my editor came to me with this prospect, precisely because I don't write, you know, from the purview of a shop floor. I don't think of people in that way. And I'm like, I'm a person who studies the Black experience more broadly. And he said to me, well, show me the book that you would write. And so I always think of my family first. I think of my mother and the stories she told me about my family. I think of my grandparents, my father, and the ways in which they wanted to educate me about Black life through their own experiences. And in part, I am a historian because of the way that they thought of history. Now, I don't know if they were thinking this is history, but the way that they taught me was that everyday people mattered and everyday experiences can tell you a lot about the world. I was an only child. I was a late baby. And they wanted me to understand the world that they had come from and that their ancestors had come from. The children of migrants. And they wanted me to have a certain kind of Southernness that they imparted to me as well. And so when I thought of the question, I thought immediately of the stories that my mother told me and my father told me. And I was like, well, if I tell it through them, if I use their lens and I find other people whose oral histories can give me that same kind of personal lens, I'll do it that way. Right. That's the way that I want to communicate what it means to be Black in America and the working class. And for me, the word promise really is about the rich survival mechanisms that result from the traumas, from the degradation, from the suffering of slavery and segregation and lynching and disfranchisement that Black people managed to carry forward with them. As the means of rebuilding and remaking family, community, and life. And that rebuilding and remaking are continuous for Black Americans, right? So it's continuous in slavery because there's that chaos, and it's continuous in segregation because they're moving, they're building new spaces, new places as they try to figure out where they can be and where they can be citizens and what their vision might be. So for me, that promise, that thing they hold because of the circumstances that they face, can teach the rest of us right. about what's important in this American experiment.
Exactly. Yeah, I think about the promise, you know, as you say very clearly in the book, the promise of what this country can be, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, there's so many amazing excerpts. I didn't mean to do this, but I have to do this. I just have to read something from it, okay. Which I think is such a beautiful passage. Didn't want to talk about something else, where you write that, you know, you're talking about Black women domestics in the urban North. And you say these women were architects. They needed a community, so they built it. They established informal childcare networks and raised money for annual picnics and reunions back home. They created the community institutions that would nurture the future, including new churches and social organizations. And you go on to describe what that is. And then you say, you know, drawing on their love for one another, their faith that despite evidence to the contrary, a broken America could be made better, they used what they had to craft a vision of what a better life could look like, rising from their knees to construct that vision. The Black work-class women who migrated ended up creating new pathways for a more expansive American democracy. That passage alone is enough for anyone to go ahead and buy the book right now, buy 10 copies and give them to 9 friends, or buy 10 copies and give them to 5 friends and 4 people you really don't like, but think you need they need to read it. So that's a beautiful passage and opens up something for me, which I want you to talk, what I want to talk about, I want you to talk about. And that is, you know, you understand class in the way that E.P. Thompson understood class, which is, it's not a thing, but a relationship. It's a relation. And, you know, thinking about what the Black working class's relationship to the dominant class is, it's always structured by, overdetermined by race and by gender. And so, you know, it's a very dynamic process. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you reveal about this relationship is, and to me, it's just so like rich, is this question of what does it mean to be skilled? Mm-hmm. What is this? We inherit these categories.
Yeah.
And sociologists use them, historians too, skilled, unskilled, but you blow that up. You take all this time and patience to describe what it means to blacksmith, what it means to wash clothes, under the circumstances where Black women are inventing ways to deal with you know, laundry and cleanliness in a way with like chemists, right? What it means to cater to passengers on a moving train, what it means to grow sweet potatoes, you know, and that's, you can't get blacker than that, right? If you don't believe it, just read Invisible Man, you know, and you'll see. Yes. And so the reason I mentioned, put all this emphasis on skills, because here we are, right? And we're dealing with the state of Florida that is talking about in their curriculum, the Department of Education, the slavery as a benefit because the skills, supposedly skills that enslaved people learn, as if they did not bring that and make them up. White people didn't teach them anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they would have starved if Africans didn't know how to grow rice. Mm-hmm. You know, and where does the sweet potato come from, West Africa?
Yes.
So I want you to talk about this question of skill and what it means for the promise of the rest of the working class that the most skilled people doing this work are the people who are paid less, the people who are considered less, the people who are invented in the white mind as second class citizens.
Yeah, I thought it was so powerful, you know, because I was reading different, you know, historic texts and reading sociology and like trying to figure out, okay, what do people, how do they define all this? And I kept running into those categories. And I was like, let's pick one of those scholars out and put them in a cotton field. Let's pick one of them out and have them make soap and boil water and get clothes clean with no modern technology. Let's see, you know, what they can do. And I was watching during the pandemic, you know, the farm workers make these beautiful reels of farm workers, like picking, packaging, and placing vegetables, fresh vegetables, out of the dirt into a basket or a receptacle in the way that we get them in the supermarket within seconds. And I was like, well, I dare anybody to do that without chopping into their arm and falling off the truck or, you know, any number of things. So, you know, this is an unskilled worker. How dare we continue to use these categories to talk about work that we can't do, that we're dependent on, and that took generational skill to build. And for me, you know, the knowledge of rice culture was how I first learned about enslavement, mm-hmm. both from in my family, because my mother's family is from South Carolina, and, you know, in graduate school, and the intricacy and the knowledge and the wisdom of Africans in those spaces is a reminder that, yes, the American experiment is built on our existing skill, not the other way around. And so, I just couldn't even begin to say, well, these jobs are skilled, these are menial and unskilled, because no.
The research that went into understanding the process, the labor process, is extraordinary. You know,
My favorite one was the sweet potatoes. I interviewed my dad about it, and he, my father has Alzheimer's, but he can remember the past perfectly. And so we sat and I interviewed him and discussed his father's skill at sweet potatoes and making the hot box. And he was doing all that in North Philadelphia in the alleyway behind his house and then taking things with him. You know, like there's things that don't even make the book that I talked to him about, of course, but just he was wise about mm-hmm. how to grow a sweet potato. He entered contests in Pennsylvania for like the prettiest sweet potato and won a few of them.
Wow.
And so I just wanted that sort of intricacy to be in the text too, because it's beautiful to me as well.
Right. You know, it just reminds me too of how those school children actually get a little bit of Black history, right? They'll learn about George Washington Carver, mm-hmm. and he's presented as like the scientist extraordinary, which he was. He was a Renaissance person. Mm-hmm. However, much of what he did was learning from Black folk, who knew the science of cultivation, knew the science, and especially the science of recycling. Mm-hmm. You know, I think about mm-hmm. even that sweet potato with the chicken manure and all the things that are being used and reused mm-hmm. to create a sustainable future.
Yep.
So again, you know, I'm not Black, but I'm very happy to be Black.
Yeah,
I shouldn't say that, but this is Haymarket. I could say that. Okay,
we are happy to be Black. It's all right.
Now I want to also turn to something else, and that is this question of, let me go to one other thing before I get to that, and that is mobility. Mm-hmm. Mobility is a theme that runs throughout the book, both in terms of the fight for mobility of a population in bondage, where that bondage continues even after slavery, mm-hmm. the importance of migration, but also you pay a lot of attention, you know, coming out of your first book, especially mm-hmm. of the technologies of mobility mm-hmm. And what that means, how it shapes the character of work and life. And that's not necessarily a theme we always see in the histories of working class. Can you talk a little bit about that and the importance of mobility in the story, both the story writ large, but also the story of your family?
I think what was powerful to me is I remember my grandfather's stories of going back, you know, being in Philadelphia and then going back home. And he would always, you know, get a real fresh suit and get a wad and cash his whole check and put it in his pocket and walk around and just act like, you know, it was wonderful. And so when I was studying migration in school, I never had the complication that my family had of migrating within the South first and then moving farther north, but then coming back home all the time. And my mother living in Winston-Salem and in Thomasville with family over the summer because her mother needed someone to care for. And so those kinds of comings and goings were part of what I understood, but I never saw reflected in any stories. They always seemed like they were permanent and true and hard, and that somehow Black Southerners became something else. And so I wanted to get that dynamism, that movement of Pullman porters who lived in the North but were in the South weekly and in contact with community. And I think it gives us a better understanding of how those networks function, how these amazing movements of people, where millions of people were able to build new lives and new places, because there is this interconnection, this movement, and this mobility. And of course, I do think that the first book is, you know, created a keen understanding of like what difference movement makes, both in resistance and fighting back against suppression and segregation laws and violence, but also what it means in terms of building pathways between places.
Right, right. Yeah, every single chapter and every single set of occupations you focus on, it's all about mobility. You know, sleeping car porters, domestic workers who were migrating, sharecroppers. Certainly, you know, when you talk about Pullman porters and Pullman maids, you draw on these really incredible narratives. I mean, C.L. Dellums is someone who should be a household name. And he's not necessarily, but I think between Robert Allen's book and your book, you've lifted him up in a way with these amazing stories. And speaking of, and of course, the post office, which is, again, we might think of the post office as a kind of stationary thing, but that's all about movement, mobility. And I love the fact that you tell this long history of the one occupation that a lot of Black, emerging Black intellectuals could always get a job, you know, at the post office, you know. So that's really important. But I want to go to this question of, it goes back to class again, the question of solidarity, because one of the themes that you also talk about is solidarity. And, you know, for a lot of folks, I think, particularly for this crowd, we think of solidarity, some of the people who think of solidarity as a product of a kind of consciousness or a kind of class consciousness, and which is tied to, you know, in a Marxist sense, labor process, division of labor. But what you find, or what you exhibit or reveal, is the importance of solidarity as a mode of self-defense against the relentless violence. And that relentless violence is a theme, again, it's not on every page, but even when it's not on the page, it lurks, you know? And so what you see is these acts of solidarity of people defending and protecting each other, which is not something that all elements of the American working class have to deal with, you know? And I love that story, which I think of as an act of solidarity of, it's your grandmother, I believe, who her mother, you know, can't take her home from work and puts her on a...
It's my mom. Yeah, it's my mom.
Your mom. Okay, yeah. It's your grandmother's working and your mom. And how, and that story about how your mom, you know, she puts a ribbon on her and says, go find someone who could basically, you know, tell you where to get off the streetcar. And of course, it's like she looks for a Black woman, and a Black woman takes responsibility. That the fact that that's not unusual tells us something about the nature of solidarity. And, you know, can you talk a little bit about that? Because solidarity, we often think of as a kind of temporary coalitional thing, but you're talking about solidarity as identity,
you know? Yeah. That story is something, because, you know, I didn't know my grandmother was a maid when I was little. She worked at the Navy Yard when I was a young person, and she was very proud of that. And that's what she wanted to do, was, you know, have that kind of white collar job. But she, you know, wasn't made for more than a decade. And so my mother told me the story of the wearing the ribbon and the note before she could read, without mentioning that her mother was a maid and the circumstances behind it. So I knew the story for a really long time. And then I knew the rest of the story later on and understood the context. My mother started telling me things about 10 years before she passed away. She started telling me the rest of those stories. And so it was amazing for me to get that story all my life, but then the fuller version of it and the suffering that my grandmother went through as a working person, not being able to care for her own child, and realizing all those circumstances. But the solidarity of the space where she gets on the streetcar and looks for a Black woman to stand in the gap for her own mother is you know, a really powerful one. I first wrote it in the first draft of my book as an anonymous example without talking about my mother or my grandmother. And my editor said, well, this is fantastical. How would this even happen? And so, well, no, it happened. So I wrote it instead as a personal story. But it's just a reminder that there, you know, what political scientists called link fate, right? So that, you know, Black voters see in each other a connection to one another. And yes, and then Black people in Black spaces or white spaces see those connections to one another as vital for survival, that they know that the circumstances of one another are shared, right? So that same woman on that streetcar knows that, well, maybe one day my children will need some help. So it's important for me to help the same way, and to recognize the humanity in each one of these moments. So many things that my mother taught me growing up come from that ethic, right? So she said, if you see a Black woman on the street unhoused, give her something. You don't know her circumstance. There could be any number of things that are driving her to that spot. So all whatever you have, you give it to her right then. You buy her food if you don't have cash. If you have cash, give her that too. And she just, you know, she said, keep 20 on you, you know, so you can do that. Mm-hmm. And I watched her do that practice walking through Philadelphia my whole life. And so that sense of meaning and possibility and leveling, right? That any one of us could be in any one of these positions at any given time. So you should take care to see that humanity. Is how she thought politically, and is how she thought personally.
Right. You know, this is a controversial question, but I'm wondering if you see a significant change from that period. And what I mean by that is, yes, we all to this day in 2023 see these acts of random solidarity and assistance between us within our communities and stuff. But there's also this sense of, okay, well, you have to be fearful. Mm-hmm. You have to, that the public is a dangerous place, including for people who look like you.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember seeing this horrific video recently of someone who pulls out a gun on a bus, and the bus driver has a gun. It's two brothers, two Black men, and they're shooting each other in front, and the bus kind of crashes. And I'm like, here's the space that once we thought of as dangerous because of the white people, but safe because we're there.
Yeah.
And I know that's kind of controversial, but I'm just wondering your reflections on what it means to think about both the promise of the Black working class and if we have lost any of that promise, or if there's a way in which we need to resurrect that sense of what's possible, in our times.
Yeah.
And I just want to make it clear, I'm not suggesting that there's like some radical change in the culture the circumstances have changed, the conditions have changed.
There's a corrosion, right? Mm-hmm. There's a corrosion of the ties that we had. There's tension. I just did an event where I had young Black people basically saying, you know, well, you know, CEOs work too. And I'm like, but they maybe, oh, okay. Let's break that down. And so there is a sort of different set of ideas that I think are also at play and influential in how people are thinking. There's a corrosion of our trust of one another. There's any number of people who aren't, you know, experiencing the same levels of fraught violence and tension and suppression, so that they think that they're, you know, that it may not affect them as much. And so there's a panoply of ways of thinking that are broader than in this earlier generation. But I still do think that these ethics are important and meaningful and can still be found in so much of how we have operated and can operate. And something that I want to pass down, not just to my own children, but to people in general, that, you know, all of us have a duty to think about one another and to imagine other people's positionality as we build policies or make institutions and direct them. And, you know, it's like I send young people out into these spaces, I want to teach them to think in these ways. And so for me, they're not essentially just have to be Black ways of thinking, but they are really humane ways of imagining the possibilities embedded in one another.
If you're enjoying the Haymarket Live series, you'll also be interested in a new book from Haymarket, Going for Broke, Living on the Edge in the World's Richest Country, edited by Alyssa Quart and David Wallace. From the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, Going for Broke gives voice to a range of gifted writers for whom economic precarity is more than just another assignment. Featuring introductions by luminaries including Michelle T., Kianga Yamada Taylor, and Astra Taylor, Going for Broke shows us the costs of income inequality to our bodies and our minds, and demonstrates real ways to change our conditions. As Gabriel Winant puts it, this moving anthology breaks down the barriers between experience and interpretation. Its contributors explore the underside of American society from many angles, but they do more than document hardship. They show how ordinary people who've been exploited and left behind forge understanding and solidarity out of the experience. Find Going for Broke at haymarketbooks.org.
Well, you say something extremely radical that for this generation, not just this generation, but even the last generation, would probably find shocking when you say that, you know, the way that Americans have, you know, thought about the idea of freedom is, you know, as you're saying, financial success.
Yes.
In a capitalist system. And what you describe when you say, you know, you talk about Sarah and other Black working class women who, you know, they had very little property. They possess their own guiding principles, which are gold. And that's my words, that could be traced to their say past. They came together to build a way of life, a working class ethic that valued the few things that the emancipation did give them: mobility, independence, and solidarity. They took skills that had made them prized property as women in bondage and put them to work for themselves. That is a complete sort of inversion of the way certain generations are thinking about success as accumulation. That, you know, they want to put that B in billionaire. They, you know, this is the description. So, you know, this, and this is a trade press. So you get you're getting away with a real overturning of this kind of ethic of materialism and returning us back, you know, and finding it not necessarily in some theoretical text, but finding it in actual practice of Black working class women. How much of that how much of that ethic do you think was passed to you, and where do you see it, and what can it do?
I think for me, you know, we hear it, and it's interesting the way in which it may not even be classed, right? You know, so much of the literature on African-American experience has focused on middle class and activists and uplift advocates. And in the ethic of uplift is the same thing, that there is this substantial duty, even amongst those who were accumulating materially in that earlier generation, that their accumulation should be about giving back, should be about a built-in duty to provide for others. So even as people who are benefiting from an elite status, they are tasked with thinking more broadly. So I think it's embedded in a working class, but I think it's a broader set of ethics that I think Black people have had to have over time. For me, I pass it down in making sure that I'm teaching my own children, I'm teaching my students, I'm teaching this next generation around me to think in those more broad terms about what is valuable. I mean, you know, I didn't get into my own career because I thought I was going to be wealthy. Good. I'm glad I didn't think that. And, but I sacrificed because the quality of my life, the kind of work I could do for others, the kinds of stories I could tell, the way I could move in the world was more important to me than, you know, I could get a cool corporate job and do ba-da-booty-ba-ba. And so, I think that's still valuable. And in this generation, I am inspired by young people who are thinking about their time, about their rest, about creating a balance, about opting out of jobs that are corrosive to their spirits and choosing things that feed them more. And so I don't know that they always have a good plan for doing that, but you know, I'm a practical Gen X person, so I always, you know, got a plan. But I do think that there is a questioning of the ethic of we all just need to stock up and get as much for ourselves as we can. And I'm inspired to see that in this striking moment in this folks who decided they need to work from home, and the folks who decided they maybe didn't need those jobs anymore. Right. Post-pandemic, I think there's a reevaluation of the things that we, you know, had built up as truth starting in the 1980s and 90s.
Exactly. That's funny because I was convinced that writing a book about the Communist Party in Alabama would make me a millionaire. Like, I don't know what happened.
You don't know.
I was waiting
you
for
still
that.
Sell them though, sir. You sell work.
Yeah. Well, let's take up from this last point, and I'm going to ask you to read something. But this last point about this moment we're in, you know, this is a moment of extreme excitement for those in the labor movement, and in so many cases, once again, at the forefront of these struggles are Black workers. You know, Black workers who work for UPS, you know, Black workers who work for Amazon, Black, you know, it so happens that, you know, the Bessemer plant was the sort of ground zero for a lot of organizers, as well as Queens in New York. And so what do you see as the potential of Black working class movement for both the future of the labor movement as a whole, but also the future of American democracy?
Yeah, I'm thankful to see a new generation move into these questions, I think oftentimes without some sort of prompting, that there's really a reckoning. And what was so important for me in Black Folk is to remind people that workers themselves understand their circumstances. Mm-hmm. They don't require someone to come and raise consciousness of things that they don't understand. Workers may not have the resources or the time or the support that they need, but they understand their circumstances. Right. And so with those resources, transformation can happen. And what was powerful for me was, you know, seeing washerwomen in 1865 in Jackson, Mississippi say, okay, we want a living wage. We want to do the work at home. That Black women's desires for that space and for certain things that are valuable to them coming out of enslavement, that they could not raise their children in as enslaved women, but they can raise them as free women. They could determine what their households look like, however simple they might be. And so those ethics were things that they figured out on their own based on their own circumstances. And so workers today are doing that again. No one prompted society to sort of say, you know, on these low paid jobs, we're not going to show up. We're not going to do that. They figured that out. They moved through the COVID moment and they saw how exploited and awfully treated they were. And they decided, we're going to do different things. We're going to come together. We're going to be abolitionists about the state around us. We're going to imagine new possibilities. And so I love the way history has reminded us of what's happening now again, that people will continue to think from all sorts of positions and all sorts of spaces that we imagine them not being intellectuals, right. That they can be thoughtful and impactful on the rest of us from any position in society.
Right. Yeah. In fact, I want to hold up some things that you do in the book, which I think are very important in terms of thinking about what does working class organizing look like. So on the one hand, I love this. It's a terrible moment, but I still think it's really, really important and profound when you have these Black women who are washerwomen who are reaching out to the Knights of Labor saying, we want a chapter. And it's the leadership of the Knights of Labor, Terrence Powderly, is like, no, you know, we don't want to organize the women. Let's try to organize the men first, and then we'll come back to them. And, you know, their advocates, like, you know, even though there may be some condescension, there's a sense that, wait a second, these women are on the move. These Black women are, in fact, at the forefront. And as we know from Tara Hunter's amazing work, you know, which I'm so happy that you really hold up, that here is the epicenter of the post-Reconstruction labor struggle right here in Atlanta, around washerwomen. And then the other thing you do, which I think is astounding, is that you pay attention to the way in which working class Black people take leadership of other kinds of freedom movements. Callie House, you know, comes out as a washerwoman. The Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters was more than just sleeping car porters. It was like the driving force under A. Philip Randolph of the March on Washington movement. The National Alliance of Postal Employees, that's where Amzie Moore comes out of that. And what I didn't know was Herman Sweat in the Sweat versus Painter, that he also was a member of National Alliance of Postal Employees. And, you know, it's like, If we make the mistake of thinking of labor history as workers in unions fighting for workplace demands, rather than this broad swath, which I try to spend my whole life trying to do myself, we miss the way in which working class struggle drives the freedom movement, drives the struggle for democracy in this country.
We've often talked about how, like, Black churches are laboratories to teach people how to speak, how to lead, how to, you know, do all those things. And they're less class emphasized spaces that do that. But these labor movements do the same thing. They train people how to think about the world, how to organize, and they build those networks of connection. You know, the Ella Baker way of understanding the civil rights movement as a series of networks and relationships. They too are a whole nother series of networks and relationships that build movement over time.
Absolutely. Can I ask you to read some passages of your choice?
Sure. Of my choice? Okay. Let's see.
I think my written. You could pick any page and it just sounds like like art.
Okay. Yeah. Let's see if I can find it. I know mine. Where is that? I had it earlier, right?
Yeah.
Oh, here it is. Invisible to Hornsby. Hornsby is the woman who comes to interview my washerwoman in her yard. Invisible to Hornsby were the skills that Sarah possessed. Sarah knew how to put the wind to work, how to make soap rise from ashes and grease, how to make industrial refuse into wash pots and fire, how to take hold of hot iron to smooth and not to burn. How to make the white people's filthy things bright and white like new. This knowledge wasn't innate. These skills were her inheritance from her sisters, both in blood and in community, passed down from woman to woman, working shoulder to shoulder in concert with one another. Taking in laundry gave Sarah the power to choose who she worked for and when, and the pace of her labor was set by no man. Her time was set by her own hand. This was work that her ancestors first learned in slavery, but then later used to establish their own households after emancipation formed the foundation of her freedom.
Mm. That's beautiful. I love how in so many passages, you step into the shoes of the individual and you describe how they move through the world in daily life. Was that always your strategy, writing?
I think I teach my students, I always say, our goal is to sit on the shoulder of the people we're writing about. And what do you see when you look out in the world if you're right on that person's shoulder? And what are their hands engaged in? And what are they thinking about? And what does their day look like? I think the work of Elsa Barkley Brown, mm-hmm. your work, Tara's work, were instructive to me in like using the archive, using the historical record to remake those little tender everyday moments that are so, so important. I think you talking about, you know, transportation spaces as like whole laboratories of life that were just, you know, when I was in school, like, oh God, okay, that's what we're going to do. And so for me, you know, that is always my goal, is to just, you know, what does that day look like? What do I know? And I spent a lot of time in my research trying to build those little details so that I can make those moments come alive.
We're having this big debate always about so-called critical fabulation. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to enter that debate right now because I don't
want to. You're not going to do it.
But what you do is, it reminds me a lot of Sarah Haley's amazing book, mm-hmm. Where it's not, I wouldn't call that critical fabulation. It is basically taking the evidence available, figuring out the texture of the times and the space, and really entering into these subjects and giving some description about what they may be thinking, mm-hmm. under those circumstances. You know, because the fact of the matter is, if we're going to be honest about the profession of history, everything is a kind of critical fabulation.
Yes, a bit.
We do. But there's making up shit, and then there's actually, you know, really taking the sort of texture of the material and trying to reconstruct that.
Yeah. I love that puzzle. Like, I enjoy, like, you could send me down a rabbit hole anytime to figure out, like, well, was it really hot that summer? And what did that look like? And what was, you know, what's the pathway between her church and her house? And how did the yards abut? And, you know, like, that kind of stuff I want to know because it entertains me. And I'm trying to make, you know, the puzzle pop with the historical record, and now I can describe it. So,
yeah. See, you're like me. I'm looking at, you know, weather on the date.
Yeah.
I'm looking at some old maps to figure out, like, exactly, trying to figure out the distance. Is it 300 feet or 500 feet?
Yeah.
And people don't realize that all that work can go into just two sentences.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. It's, I was looking at the house that C.L. Dellums walks to off the train. So I located the train stop. What was the walk to the house? What does the house look like on that corner? It, you know, and so how do I describe it correctly? What kind of architecture is that? And, you know, like, so I spent a lot of time on things that, you know, were two sentences.
Exactly. Exactly. See, that's another thing we have in common.
Yes.
You know, we're Blairs and Kellys.
Yes. Well, I'm in your footsteps following behind you, sir. So
I'm trying to live through and behind yours. So, okay, before we continue our conversation, I want to let people know that this is a good time. If you have questions, you could put them in the chat. And, you know, questions, comments, we're all invited. And this is your opportunity. And also, for those of you who may not have questions right now, this is probably a good time to order the book. It's always great to buy books through Haymarket itself, you know, because you got to support Haymarket independent bookstores. Don't buy it through Amazon unless you have no other choice. But I think you could think of some other choices. But either way, you cannot not have this book because it is really a classic. And I'm almost embarrassed because I spent so much of my life writing the thing I think of as labor history. And you just came along and just blew it all out the water in such a beautiful way. So I so appreciate it.
You're doing too much, sir. Doing too much.
I'm just saying. Okay, so let us go to another thing that's on my mind, and that is culture and community. You know, it is amazing how much of the stories take place not at the workplace, you know, but in all these other spaces. Can you talk about the importance of culture in those community spaces in terms of the creation or the self-invention, self-fashioning of the Black working class?
I think again of my mother immediately, and she would tell me, like, you know, if you were an elevator operator back in the day, that was an important job. That meant that the white people had let you into their building and they trusted you to run their machinery, and you were greeting customers. And so you were probably a little educated and pulled together, and you made a decent salary. So that was a very good job. Mm-hmm. Don't think that wasn't a good job. And she taught me about the Pullman porters, and that, you know, the people that in her community who were Pullman porters were so esteemed and as seen as the foremost leaders in that space. And postal work was a good job and is a good job. And that we should defend that as a good job in our own contemporary circumstances. And so for me, if you atomize a profession and think of it only in the locus of where it happens, and you separate it from that community context, you lose part of its meaning. You know, I had a battle at a certain point where it was like, well, are Pullman porters working class people? Because they were so imbued with authority within community at a certain point. But, you know, they work for hourly wages and tips. They are, you know, the service sector of the economy. And so even though we know them in this broader context, that's the work they did. And that they had to tolerate in order to have, you know, that stature outside of those train cars. And so it for me, that broader context tells you more than the work site can. People are not what they do. They are more than what they do. And that meaning should inform how we think of what's possible and what we can learn from them. Right. And there's the other thing is that, you know, oftentimes when I'm in kind of university spaces, people say, well, you know, what do you do? You know, like that when they meet you, you know, like, my name is Blair. What do you do? Explain your job. What's going on at your job. And I'll spend a lot, you know, excessive time describing what I do to certain people. And then if I'm in Black spaces, no one ever asks me, they'll be like, oh, you at the university. And then they move on to some other thing about who I am, about my family, about where I'm from, about community, and where did I grow up, and who am I related to, and are we at all connected, and surely your family must be connected, my family in this particular kind of way. You know, so they spend time finding you in a different network of relation that has very little to do with what you do on a day-to-day basis. And for me, that's what I wanted to reflect, is that there is a different sense of, like, who you are.
Yes, that's amazing, because it, you know, it's diasporic, that way of thinking. I mean, my Jamaican and Cuban side of my family are exactly the same way. You know, they really don't care that much about, like, what you do at your job, unless you're writing a book about them. You know? But other than that, it's more, a lot of it's about connection. Mm-hmm. You meet someone, who are your people, as Ella Baker used to say, who are your people? And we do that too. And yet in our spaces in academia, the first question usually is, what are you working on?
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, I'm working on getting away from you. But that's just me. Okay, so no questions yet. But let me ask too about working class culture. And the reason is, you know, I start out talking about E.P. Thompson, mm-hmm. And definitions of class. And in fact, you reminded me that, you know, my really dear, dear, dear friend, almost like my brother, Earl Lewis, mm-hmm. Has really pioneered this question of rethinking class, mm-hmm. right? Thinking about class in certainly not just in cultural terms, but not always a set of relations that are strictly economic and material, in that, you know, you can have cases, and this comes out in your book, where someone might be a Pullman porter, or someone might be a school teacher and make less money than a steel worker, right? Mm-hmm. And still the question of who is of the upper class, and the upper and lower class thing doesn't work the same way. There's mm-hmm. a kind of cultural capital mm-hmm. That comes, and that cultural capital is not always seen as antagonistic.
Yes.
Something you strive for. So anyway, so we have a question from Bess.
Okay.
For you. You speak about the migration. Were there any compromises made by the Southerners during the migration which affected and changed your identity?
Yeah, I definitely feel like I talk about a woman named Minnie who migrates from Accomack County, where my grandfather is from, around the same time as he does, and her beautiful oral history I lean on very heavily. And, you know, she has breaks with her family who does not want her to leave. So she basically runs away from home to migrate at 16. She is struggling with her disappointment about what she can do and what's available to her when she gets to the city. And for a generation, she really has to put up with very bad workspaces, even though she has very firm senses of who she is as a person. And she has to change her sense of being a wife, being a mother, being a daughter, in order to accommodate this tremendous change. And it's a strain on her. And you can see right. the strain on her and her life and her marriage and her family. But I think what was important for me is to keep her in relationship to the place she came from, because she's always using that as a measure of the world. And the vision that she had hoped for in rural Accomack County isn't realized immediately, but she builds it over time, and she builds it in relationship to the place that she's from. So she goes home, she's connected to home. She still sees the struggles that made her leave in the first place as key to the things that she wants to change right. in the next generation. So I love her story, and it's a tremendous oral history, because she really does so honestly reveal the painful challenges that she went through.
Right, right. Yeah, and you know, what's interesting too about that story is the importance that you place on agency. Because, you know, we think, you know, there's been all those debates about like push-pull factors in migration, yes. which is just so tired.
Yeah.
And in fact, you tell a story of someone who, how she escapes is really hip. Got to read the book.
Yeah.
But it is a kind of an escape in order for her to be free mm-hmm. from a kind of patriarchal, suffocating space that clearly loves her, but she's trying to find her own way. And for a lot of young women, I'm sure that was a factor in mm-hmm. making a decision to make that leap mm-hmm. like that, as opposed to like, is it the boll weevil, you know, or it's a threat of lynching, you know, like that's all it is.
Yeah.
You know? And that's really quite beautiful. Mm-hmm. So part of the, I'm really curious about this question, the part about compromises. Mm-hmm. Do you find also a kind of remaking of identity or even Southern identity in the face of maybe hostile, settled Black families?
Oh, yes. Yes. I think that that's the other piece of what is shunting so many Black men and Black women into professions that they would not prefer, is that, you know, they are not welcomed into more elevated spaces by an elite Black population who is, you know, spending a lot of time judging and worrying about the effect of Black migrants to cities that cannot physically accommodate all the people who are coming, and you know, cannot physically accommodate them because they don't want them to live in any other neighborhoods other than the ones that Black people are already in. And so it puts pressure on the positionality that sort of the long-term folks, particularly in Philadelphia, had made for themselves. And so there are people who are concerned about it and helpful and in constructive ways. And there are people who are like, oh gosh, this is not what we're going for. And so you see both sides of that coin too for migrants.
Right. Were you already working on your family history before you signed a contract?
I've been working on my family history just for me, just for mm-hmm. myself, for probably 12, 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
It entertains me to no end. Like if I have anything like free time, I will sit with my Ancestry app and just pick around and look at documents and see what pops up. And I have about 26 different family trees for my family and other families. I'll do them for friends. I do them for any historical figure. Everybody in this whole book has a tree on Ancestry from me. I even mm-hmm. connected to some of the ancestors of people I was writing about and helped them figure things out for their own trees.
Wow. That's good.
So yeah, no, I was just working on it. And then all the sort of web of interconnected things that I began to research for Black folk kept fitting into my family. So, you know, I found a washerwoman who was from Elbert County, where my family was from in Georgia. I found Minnie, who was from a tiny little Accomack County in the Eastern Shore of Virginia. I kept finding all these interconnections that let me know that the ancestors had heavy hand in what this looks like.
Segue to the next question. Since you do spend a lot of time talking about place
mm-hmm.
and relationships to land and how, you know, and soil and yeah. how, you know, you can't, that old thing that we all grew up hearing, like, although it was said in more profane ways, you can take Black people out the South, but you can't take the South out of Black people. Although mm-hmm. we said it differently.
Yes.
So the question is, how do you figure place and or land in your thinking and writing?
I was really obsessed with trying to make sure I understood the context, the longer context of every place I talked about. I didn't want to just sort of drop in on places and assume I understood what it meant or what it was like or what the land looked like or what the trees were or what any of that stuff was. So I spent a lot of time thinking about Native presence in places and starting there as much as I could, and then building out to think about the impacts of the particularities of location in what was possible for people. And so I studied Elbert County and found some really amazing documents about Elbert County over time and how the enslaved and free experienced that land. And I read about Turkey, a place called Turkey in North Carolina, that, you know, my postal worker is originally from, his family is from, because that land was such an impactful piece of how he talked in his own oral history. I spent a lot of time learning about Accomack. I visited Accomack, talked to my father and my uncle about being there. And so I wanted to spend time making an intimate speaking about each one of these places because they were so meaningful to the people that I was writing about. And I just didn't want to get anything wrong about what I was talking about.
Making sure that we saw the whole country. I mean, because you got Texas and California and Oklahoma and Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, throughout the Eastern Seaboard. I mean, it's all people are crisscrossing here and there. Salt Lake City.
Yes.
So you see, I did read the book very carefully.
I know that. You read it a couple times.
Yeah, a couple times. And it's just amazing how in telling stories, individual stories, you're able to construct a whole world, you know, and really capture the regional differences, but also the way that so many of our ancestors have had to straddle these regional spaces. I mean, you know, so we think of land in place as settlement, but for a lot of the subjects you write about, there's the hope of settlement, but mm-hmm. there's also the constant dispossession. And of course, we think of dispossession in terms of indigenous original stewards of the land, mm-hmm. but there's even on stolen land, mm-hmm. the fact that you have Black people being dispossessed constantly and mm-hmm. being pushed out, dispossessed of jobs, dispossessed mm-hmm. of careers, dispossessed of occupations, and dispossessed of land that they purchased that was mm-hmm. stolen from them. Mm-hmm. And all that is captured so well. And we understand why, you know, after going through all that, and we're still here.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing.
Yeah. And the, you know, when you point to like, oh, there's a wealth gap and Black people don't have, you know, this intergenerational wealth. Well, yeah, this is why it's not a lack of trying or a lack of focus. Mm-hmm. It is an active process of dispossession, as you said.
It's one of the amazing strengths of the book as well is that, you know, even though in the epigraphs, you have that one Vince Brown, I'm just going by memory here, where he talks about like it's important not just to deal with conditions, and you deal with both. You deal with both the conditions of Black working class life and what they had to endure, the ability to persevere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I never liked the word resilient. Because
no, I hate that word.
Yeah, I know. I don't like it. I don't like it.
I also don't like grit.
Right. Right. I mean, those don't work because you're talking about something a little different. That is developing collective modes of survival and let's call it social reproduction, the ability of people to really keep going generation after generation, passing knowledge, finding ways to protect each other and having to endure things that mess up their lives. And mm-hmm. so in some ways, the explanation for what we think of as a wealth gap, which is just capitalism, as Kanga Yamada Taylor tells us, you lay that out, you describe that and reveal it in the process of telling these stories.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm.
So we got about 5 minutes left, and I don't want to leave you unless I ask this question. Besides running the center, what's next?
Well, I have a vision of, and I don't know when I'm going to do this, sir. I have like three more books I'd like to write. One, I propose more chapters in my original proposal of Black folk. So I had a chapter on the military and shipyards. I had a chapter about auto workers in Detroit, which I think are crucial. And right. I wanted to talk about, you know, more explicitly about the 70s and the 80s and the creation of a wealth gap in what happens to Black property, and using Kenyatta's amazing work and thinking through those kinds of questions moving forward. So I'm thinking I might write like another book.
Black folk too.
I think I want to call it like Good Jobs. but you know, I think that this story was more of my grandparents' generation. So I was thinking, you know, through my father's generation, you know, the generation that first moves into integrated space, so to speak, and then, you know, their lifetime and their experiences. And so I'm interested in thinking through those sets of questions. And I've done some research on those chapters that I just knew I was going to write a doorstop book and I didn't want to do that. And then I have a murder case in Philadelphia that I want to write about that takes place in 1944. A Black woman who's a maid who murders the white woman she cleans house for. And a lot of the research I have on Philadelphia and maids comes from that original. That was what I was working on when I was approached.
You and Colly Gross finding all these people, all these Black people killing people, all these white people killing people. I mean, it's like Philadelphia, it really is a place of a lot of murder cases.
Yes, yes. I really would love to write about that because it's all finished and sitting in a box somewhere.
Wow, that's great. That's great. Yeah. Callie's books are really, really terrific.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. The disembodied torso book is amazing and crazy. And I also want to write about Houston and think in terms of the military, Black military servicemen who are targeted and arrested for defending a Black woman there. Right. And to write it from the point of view of the men who were jailed and spent significant time in federal prison because of that advocacy of her freedom and her safety. And wow. So those are my three that I have in mind, but I'm, you know, there's only so much time here on the earth. So I don't know if I can, but I'm trying to get like you.
Right. So I'm trying to think. So that's, those three different movies then. Cause the story in Houston, that's a movie. The murder case is a movie. And in fact, Black Folk is a movie. Mm. There's a movie there. And all I'm saying is that the one scene you do not want to let anyone cut from that movie is a scene of your mother on that streetcar. Mm. Like that has to go in the movie. Yeah. I mean, if they can make a movie of Cast, Isabel Wilkerson's book, then you know Black Folk could be a movie.
Okay.
So that's the next stage. So you'll be making a movie. Existence. All right. Make a movie. Okay, so no more questions, and I could talk to you forever, but then you won't be able to finish these three books. So it's always great, always great, always great to talk to you. And I wish you, I don't have to wish you luck because the book is out and it's doing really, really well. And I just want to remind audiences that you really have to read it, that our conversation just is a tease. It just touches the surface of all the depth and richness that's in Black Folk, you know. So I would say thanks again for being here.
I appreciate you reading it again and again and providing me with such beautiful frames to talk about it. So this is high up on that list, sir. You're at the top. For me.
Yeah, I'm trying to get to the top with you. So anyway, enjoy, everyone. Get the book. Thanks again, Blair, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.